The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of Mouth.
Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Imagine, if you can, an outspoken political outsider as presidential candidate. He's thin on policy, big on touting his celebrity, and fiercely confrontational. He draws enormous crowds who roar in approval and promises to steadfastly defend the country and vows to fix the corrupt system that's keeping the common man down. His rivals are stunned. Party leaders don't know what to do. And yes, he has really distinctive hair. We are, of course, talking about Andrew Jackson and the election of 1824. And Brady Carlson, NHPR's weekend host and our residential presidential historian, is here. Perhaps you have seen his book, Dead Presidents, briefly noted by the New Yorker magazine. Well, Brady Carlson, so glad you'll still talk with us.
I'm happy to be here.
We could have been describing Donald Trump, of course. Andrew Jackson, they have a lot in common. He was also a celebrity. How did he make his name?
Well, Andrew Jackson was the hero of the Battle of New Orleans, the big final victory for the Americans in the War of 1812. That happened to come a few weeks after the peace treaty ending the war was signed. But nonetheless, it was a huge shot in the arm morale-wise for the United States at the time, and General Jackson, being at the center of that victory, became a national hero and managed to keep his name in the headlines through some of his other military and then political exploits leading up until the election of 1824.
There is, of course, still Jackson Square in New Orleans. What are some of the other similarities, though? I mean, it's really quite uncanny in some ways.
Well, there's a feeling that here's a figure who, his own personal history aside, is representing common people against the powerful and wealthy elites. I mean, Andrew Jackson owned a very large plantation in Nashville, Tennessee. He had made a lot of money in real estate. He was a sitting U.S. senator at the time. So this idea that he was a political outsider in 1824 was a bit overstated. But nonetheless, that was the idea that he was the one sort of shaking up the system. And there were a lot of people on his side who were not part of the usual genteel politics of the time. This was the first, by the way, election where some states were deciding who would get the electoral votes by a popular vote instead of electing individuals as electors who would then choose a president for the state and for the country.
Uh-huh.
So that opened up a whole new avenue for a candidate like Andrew Jackson that wouldn't have been available before.
So he did, in the parlance of the day, draw a whole new population of voters to the table?
It was a whole new coalition coalescing behind him. And because of his celebrity, and of course because he was a military hero, and going back to the days of George Washington, Americans had looked to military heroes as potential presidents, and those factors started to build a groundswell around his campaign.
Mm-hmm. He also was famously thin-skinned, apparently, and quite a rabble-rouser. He had his own sort of shady, or let's say he carried a lot of baggage with him.
He had a volcanic temper, to put it mildly, and had killed someone at least one time in a duel, had fought quite a few, and had the bullets in his body to tell the tale. And in fact, Jackson's own story in his duel was he had taken a shot that landed nearly next to his heart. That would have felled a much lesser person, but he got back up. And under the rules of dueling, you get the next shot if you take the first shot. So he very calmly composed himself, and the other guy had to stand there and wait, and Jackson shot and killed him.
Mm.
Frightening.
Was he married to a model?
This is more a difference, I suppose, than a similarity. Jackson was married to a woman named Rachel, who he loved very much, and he was considered very gentlemanly toward women, and in fact would get very uncomfortable and angry when people would denigrate or insult women. There was some question about whether Mrs. Jackson's divorce from her previous husband had gone through when the two of them got together. And when Jackson ran for president, the backers of his main opponent, John Quincy Adams, brought that up very often and very loudly. That say, well, these two were, what exactly were they doing if they weren't quite married? And Jackson's wife died shortly after the election, and he always maintained that that was because she had seen the accusations which were being made about her character and her virtuousness and was so shocked, as a decent Christian woman would have been at that time, that it killed her. And he said, you know, God forgive my enemies. Lord knows I never will.
Whoa.
Which is pretty scary stuff coming from Andrew Jackson.
Someone, old Hickory, I guess, as they called him. Okay, so they certainly had a lot in common, but especially their success being so confounding to party leaders at the time. So give us a little bit of background on this general election of 1824. Who was Jackson up against?
Well, there were a couple of different candidates. John Quincy Adams was the sitting Secretary of State under the previous president. And the way that it had been working up to that point was that the Secretary of State was next in line. The two previous presidents, James Monroe and James Madison, had both served in that job before moving up to the presidency. And in fact, 4 years earlier in 1820, there had been such a consensus around James Monroe's reelection that there had been no real opposition. He ran almost completely unopposed. And so there was an idea at the time that a group of stakeholders, powerful people in what was the only real party at the time, the Democratic Republican Party, would sort of choose a candidate. So Adams was the next in line by the Secretary of State tradition. There was another guy named William Crawford who was a well-known party insider, and the caucus process of the day said, let's go with Crawford. Well, Jackson said, well, I don't want to just go with the next in line, and I don't want to go with the caucus choice. I'm as popular as either of them, and I think I'd do a great job. I'm going to go in. And then, of course, there was also another powerful player in that election, which was Henry Clay, who was a well-known congressional figure, the great compromiser. He was known as a huge political force of the day. And so you have four legitimate political forces at the time all pulling against each other.
And Henry Clay, didn't he throw his support behind Adams, right? If I'm reading the history right, let's put it that way.
The way that it works is in that election, no one got a majority of the electoral votes. And when that happens under the Constitution, it goes to the House of Representatives, which then chooses the next president. There were four candidates, and only the top three get to be part of that election process in the House. Henry Clay finished fourth, so he was out. But as a very well-known political figure in Congress, he had a lot of sway with who Congress might choose. Depending on who you talk to, Clay went to both Adams and Jackson, the two top vote getters. Jackson finished first, and offered that he would sway the House in that candidate's favor if he were to have some large role, maybe the Secretary of State, in the new administration. According to Jackson and his people, he turned the deal down, but Adams then wound up winning the election in the House, even though he had finished second in the electoral vote, and then named Henry Clay his Secretary of State. So to Jackson, that confirmed this idea that Henry Clay had made a deal, he called it the corrupt bargain, and that swayed the House in Adams' favor, even though he was the second place candidate.
Okay, so Adams became the sixth president of the U.S., Clay became a Secretary of State. This is 1824. Then 1828, lining things up for an even more bitter, ill-tempered presidential campaign. What happened?
Well, originally, as the election was first decided, Jackson and Adams sort of shook hands and said, well, great job, you know, nice and good game, the way that people do at the end of a Little League game or something like that. But after Adams names Henry Clay his Secretary of State, Jackson is convinced something's rotten in Denmark, that the powerful elites, the caucus system, the party bosses had struck a blow not only for Adams but against him. And he said, I am not going to take this sitting down. Almost immediately, he instructs some of his lieutenants to build a new political party, a new political movement, and start running a campaign for that 1828 election. And their strategy was essentially twofold. Show Jackson as the man who stands up for the common people, and show Adams as completely beholden to the party bosses and completely ineffective. And Adams, who was a thoughtful and capable and qualified person, but at the time a very poor politician, who once told Congress, we need to make sure that our decisions are, and I'll just quote, not palsied by the wills of our constituents. So saying, essentially, don't let those idiots in your districts screw up your votes. Think harder than they will. And that did not go over well. It was more fuel for Jackson to say, see, this guy doesn't understand us. He doesn't understand our people. He doesn't understand our movements. And the election in 1828 was very different. It was a Jackson, he took it in a walk.
Thomas Jefferson once said of Andrew Jackson, he is one of the most unfit men I know of for such a place. That august place he was describing, Office of the President. Our residential presidential expert, Brady Carlson, is with me. He's describing the many similarities in temperament and tactics between Andrew Jackson and current Republican frontrunner Donald Trump, especially Jackson's populist appeal in the bitterly contested elections of 1824 and 1828. A lot of people within the party are saying, okay, this Trump thing, you know, completely caught us off guard, but maybe it is time for a shakeup in the Republican Party. Maybe things that just haven't been working. Did they get that shakeup with Andrew Jackson?
They certainly did. The Jackson-led party was a very different kind of party, appealing to that common interest. Jackson's own personal politics became the focus of the party. He was, for example, very heavily in favor of westward expansion at the expense of the Native Americans who lived in those lands, and he removed them very forcibly and very violently. Jackson also, unlike Trump, very much distrusted money and banks. He was a big believer in gold and what they called specie at the time. He did not believe in paper money and worked very hard to limit and then eventually just destroy the National Bank. And then what happened as a result of that was the people who didn't believe in Andrew Jackson wound up forming their own political party. So it was called the Whig Party. Long story short, the idea, it was a throwback to the British
Whigs,
which were founded as a check on the power of the king. So they're making a direct reference and saying, here is a man who has too much personal power in the presidency of the United States. And so they named their party, essentially, the whole point of our party is to oppose Andrew Jackson.
Well, it's so interesting, Brady, because, you know, this is a guy who clearly didn't play by the rules, was not, you know, presidential and genteel in his language or his actions. And a lot of people who are looking at the rise of Donald Trump and trying to figure out how this happened, you know, how did people get so far away from the establishment, are saying, well, he's a byproduct of America's obsession with reality TV and celebrity or you know, even hearkening back to the fascism and the rise of Hitler in early 20th century. But this was long before either of those, the rise of Andrew Jackson. So is there a strain in American politics that's bigger than these contemporary questions?
You know, in a lot of ways, there's nothing new under the sun here. I mean, certainly there are things with Donald Trump that we haven't seen before, or at least certainly haven't seen in a long time. I think what it speaks to really in a lot of ways is that there are from time to time these populist movements that crop up. And it's not something that's to the left or to the right, but you'll see a populist movement that crops up either that feels like the government is getting too strong or certain interests are getting too strong or the political party leaders themselves are getting too strong and not necessarily representing the people who are at the bottom rung of the ladder. Even sort of leading up into the last few years, I mean, we saw both the Occupy movement and the Tea Party movement, not necessarily always organic or always a grassroots movement, but tapping into this feeling among a lot of people who are disaffected, disenchanted, or disappointed with modern politics, saying, well, something's not right here, and all we need is some kind of vehicle by which to represent and express that frustration and that disappointment. And along comes a well-known figure who can say, I'm right there with you. I feel just as frustrated as you do. Let's do something about it together. And here we go.
Well, that is also the kind of sentiment that got Jesse Ventura elected as governor of Minnesota. So what happens after that? You know, this flush of new energy, this anti-establishment. How do politics end up after that?
It's interesting that you mentioned Jesse Ventura, because what we have seen over the last few decades in politics is that you've seen the parties really trying to recruit not necessarily experienced politicians or public servants, but people who are well known, so that voters who don't pay a whole lot of attention to the day-to-day workings of a state house or a city council will have somebody that they can say, oh, I like that person. I'm going to vote for him. So you've seen football players who've run for office. You see pro wrestlers like Jesse Ventura, or movie stars run for office.
Arnold Schwarzenegger
is a great example. And so a lot of times what you see is that kind of figure cropping up, just not usually at this level. And so seeing a well-known figure who most people know not just as a real estate tycoon or a business person, but as a reality TV star saying, I'm running for president of the United States. That maybe is a new thing. In Jackson's case, and certainly he had a power base in Congress at the time. Mm-hmm. But more importantly, what he was able to argue, and really for the first time in American politics, was the only person who is elected by all of the people and by extension represents all of the people is the president of the United States. The Speaker of the House does not represent the entire country. The leaders of the Senate do not represent the entire country. Only the president does. And through that call to the power of his office and the responsibility of the office as the one true representative of the voice of the people, he's able to say, I have a mandate to push these policies through. And that, I think, is something that maybe was easier to do in 1828 than it might be in 2016 or 2017. But I guess, you know, there have been a lot of predictions made about what's going to come in American politics in the next few months, and so many of them have not panned out. So, you know, it's hard to say what's going to come next.
Okay, no predictions, a lot of scratching of the head. Brady Carlson, thank you very much for joining us.
Sure, thank you.
Brady Carlson, he's NHPR's weekend host and our in-house presidential historian of sort, author of the book Dead Presidents. More on the book at wordofmouthradio.org. Among the many things President Andrew Jackson is remembered for is signing the Indian Removal Act into law. The act is a blight on American history and paved the way for the Trail of Tears, the forced relocation of the Cherokee Nation that resulted in more than 4,000 deaths. In 2009, producer Jordan Nelson first met up with a group of young Cherokees retracing the path of removal.
It's 11 in the morning as I drive into Speedy's gas station to meet the cyclists. They ride in on the highway and stop here, about 5 miles outside Tahlequah, Oklahoma, before riding into town. There's a festive atmosphere. Families have decorated their cars with shoe polish and hold signs as the cyclists ride into the station. A few weeks ago, these cyclists set out on a journey. Todd Inlow, the group's chaperone and leader, explains.
We are retracing the Trail of Tears as part of the Cherokee Nation, and the title of the project is called Remember the Removal. We started out basically 3 weeks ago, drove for 2 days, and officially started the bike ride starting at New Echota, Georgia. We're riding back to Tahlequah, Oklahoma. About 20 days, right at 1,000 miles is what we've traveled.
These 12 cyclists are all citizens of the Cherokee Nation, most of them between 16 and 24 years old, and Todd says the purpose of the ride for the young cyclists was twofold.
One is to teach them about the history of the removal, and the Cherokees prior to removal. And then the other thing is to teach them about themselves and what they can accomplish on their own level.
But Wyatt Collins, one of the participants, says the purpose of the ride wasn't only to teach the cyclists their own history.
The purpose of this ride was to bring awareness about the Trail of Tears. A lot of people don't really know a whole lot about what happened and all the events, and so we was kind of there to bring awareness to that, to bring interest. We loved it when people would ask us questions and we'd tell them.
170 years ago, the Cherokees were living in the southeastern United States. That is, until President Jackson's Indian removal policy caught up with them. In the winter of 1838, the Cherokees were rounded up and forced to march west to present-day Oklahoma, resulting in the death of an estimated thousands of Cherokees. Cyclist Sarah Holcomb says this history stayed in her mind during the ride.
It's been quite a journey. It's been really hard. I don't know how many times I wanted to quit. I didn't. When I wanted to quit, no, my people didn't have a choice to stop me, you know, and be like, you know, I don't want to do this. You know, they were made, and this is my choice, you know. So that's what really pushed me through.
After a few more minutes of meeting with friends and family, the cyclists are ready to complete the trip. They've invited members of the public to meet them on bicycle and ride these last few miles of the journey with them. So we saddle up and head out on the highway. The cyclists, accustomed to riding 60 and 70 miles a day, finish strong as the guest riders struggle to keep up. As we ride into town, people line the streets with signs, flags of the Cherokee Nation, balloons. Cars pull to the side of the road and honk their horns and yell out words of support as the cyclists snake through the streets of Tahlequah, the Cherokee Nation's capital. As we make the last turn to the Cherokee Courthouse Square, a crowd of about 300 people is gathered under the shade of the trees. The cyclists dismount and are greeted with a hero's welcome. Sarah meets with her family, including her mother, for whom this trip is particularly special.
My name is Sherry Holcomb. I'm Sarah's mother. I rode the first bike trip back 25 years ago in 1984.
The trip these cyclists have just completed is actually the second of its kind, a revival of the one Sarah's mother rode in the 80s. And while Sarah says she didn't feel pressured to make the ride, her mother did have an influence.
Well, I remember her telling me, you know, when I was little, all the time, you know, she rode it and she told me about it, and I was like, well, you know, I think I want to try it, you know. She had a lot to do with me riding on this.
The cyclists address the crowd that has gathered and reflect on their journey and how it has changed them. Again, Wyatt Collins.
After completing this daunting task, it has shown to me with the hard work and dedication, you can pretty much do just about anything you want.
Todd Inlow says with the success of this year's ride, he hopes to make this an annual event, allowing a new group of young Cherokees to retrace the trail each year.
And our thanks to producer Jordan Nelson for that story. Remember, the removal is now an annual event. The bike ride takes place over 3 weeks and covers 950 miles. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. It is spring in New England, always welcome, but after a mild winter doesn't feel quite so euphoric or so hard won as usual, or as last year, certainly. We wondered how the warming climate affects the natural world, and birds in particular, those harbingers of spring. Eric Masterson is with us. He is author of Bird Watching in New Hampshire. Eric, great to have you back with us.
Great to be here, Virginia. Thanks for having me on.
So we did have a very mild winter, especially when comparing the heavy snow of 2014 and cold of 2013. So how, maybe even going back to those other years, how does that affect bird migration here in New England?
Well, the first thing to recognize is the birds start moving at the end of February when the first blackbirds and show up and waterfowl starts moving. So really, we've just got a month to look at. But still, it's a really good question. So last year, if we just look at waterfowl, last year waterfowl movement peaked in early April because I still remember last year. It's seared into my memory. I had to shovel so much snow. And so that slowed down waterfowl migration relative to this year by a full month. So waterfowl has already moved through. It basically peaked in early March up the Connecticut River Valley and the Merrimack River Valley.
Okay, so now this is an early migration then. What are we seeing now in New England, especially because of this mild winter? Did they arrive early?
Yeah, so if you can think of migrants as long-distance migrants, the ones that winter in the tropics and South America, versus near-distance migrants that might winter in Connecticut down to the Gulf states, and they can respond to weather here because they're here and they know if North American climate is unseasonably warm versus a bird that's in Brazil doesn't have any idea. So those birds tend to migrate when they migrate the same every year, and they get here when they get here, which is usually for those birds in May. But the near distance migrants like phoebes and blackbirds, all of those birds that arrive in March and April are showing up early. So I have my first phoebes at the house. This is a great time for folks to learn birdsong, I should point out, because in May, when the forests are just alive with song, it's really hard for beginners. But if you start tuning in now as birds dribble in, especially early birds like pine warblers. So in May, we'll have 25 species of warbler passing through the state. Right now, you'll hear two species maximum, yellow-rumped warbler and pine warbler. And people think of birdsong. They most often think of warblers because they're such vocal birds. And so now you just have to sort out two species. And as the weeks progress, you'll add one here, one there. And, I think it's a great way to learn your song.
Well, let's listen to just a few of those. Let's hear from the pine warbler. And also you mentioned phoebes. Let's hear from the eastern phoebe. So what is coming now for the more distant migrating birds, and where are we going to see them?
Right now, they're in Texas, in southern states, because it's a long way from Brazil. So they started out in February, and right now they're heading into the lower 48, and they'll get here in early May. So that would be Blackburnian warblers, bay-breasted warblers. There's, like I say, there's 25 species of warblers, the indigo buntings, some species of sparrows. There are quite a number of birds, flycatchers. There are quite a number of birds that don't get here till May, basically because they have to come from so far away. It's really a direct correlation.
So what happens in a case, Eric, like this year when, you know, the ground has been clear for a long time? So a lot of food has been picked out already by, you know, moles, grubs, squirrels are already out of their dens. Any competition or any shortage of food in a case like this when the birds come home to roost?
Absolutely, yeah. I have a colleague at the Harris Center, Mead Caddo, and he's a huge proponent of feeding birds in spring. And his argument, and it's a good argument, his argument is that the production of food happens in summer and fall, and then it's eaten through winter. And by this time of year, there's really slim pickings. And it's at odds, I think, with Fish and Game, who would like everyone to take their feeders down in spring because of bears. But the reality is this is a time of food scarcity. And so I feed birds. I take my feeders down at night. And so I try and do right by Fish and Game's advice. But I do feed the birds now because when they get back, certainly until the flowers are out on trees and there's some insect biomass around, there's really not a lot in the way of food.
So any interesting behavior that a birder is likely to observe in the month of April, in the spring, mating, nesting?
Yeah, I mean, I can think of a couple of species that are really, really cool. So woodcock are a species of shorebird. They're an early returnee, and right now they're displaying. Males do these fantastic flights where at dusk and dawn they fly up and make these twittering sounds by air passing through specially narrowed feathers on their wings. So it's not actually, it's a sound that's easily heard, but not produced by the voice box of the bird. It's produced by air passing through the wing feathers. And they do these display flights to attract females and ward off other competing males. Snipe is another shorebird that has a similar display flight, and you can see those in anywhere where there's a potential for a bird to attract mates. So that, you know, for a woodcock that would be meadows, ball fields. Snipe prefer more boggy habitat, and then there's killdeer, which is another shorebird. I'm picking on the shorebirds. Killdeer are another shorebird that arrives early, and they tend to nest on gravel banks. You can find them often in school places where you get extensive gravel patches. So I'm thinking of schoolyards, construction sites. They nest on the ground, and because they nest on the ground, they're somewhat at risk of being trod on or of a fox finding the eggs, the chicks. And so they have this wonderful broken wing display where they will call, if they see an intruder approach the nest, they will call loudly and stagger away with an apparent broken wing. But it's a trick to basically lure the threat away from the nest. And so they're setting up nests now, and they're quite a common bird. So there are three birds with three behaviors that are really cool to see.
All right. And since you mentioned that we should keep our ears out for them as well, let's hear a little bit from, let's hear the woodcock. And the killdeer, the great actor of the bird family that does this broken wing display. So, Eric, any significant rare bird sightings so far this spring?
Well, it's funny you should ask. This spring, of all springs, and I've been in this state 15 years, this spring has been the most remarkable. So we had two birds that stand out. In early March, a tufted duck, which is a European species of duck that breeds as close as Iceland. A stunning male showed up in a pond in Salem and attracted bird watchers from all over New Hampshire.
Wow.
People were very excited. First time it's ever been seen in the state. Huh. And if that wasn't exciting enough, that bird was rare, but it was blown out of the water by a redwing, which was exponentially rarer. There's only four previous records of redwing in the eastern United States, and one showed up in Hollis feeding with blackbirds. It's a species of thrush, not to be confused with
the redwing blackbird.
Yeah, completely different. The redwing blackbird is obviously a blackbird, and this is a a species of thrush closely related to the American robin, and it was feeding with robins on the baseball fields of Hollis High School. And you can tell a lot by a rarity, by the company it keeps. And this bird attracted birders from all over the United States, as far away as Toronto, Michigan. People got up at 1 a.m. in New York to drive up to see it. It stayed for 4 days. It was really quite remarkable.
Well, outside of that, any birding events you're highlighting right now for the spring?
Yeah. As I do every spring, I lead trips out to Star Island, which is the best, in my opinion, the best migration hotspot in New Hampshire. Audubon is doing its annual spring birdathon, which is a friendly competition to see as many species as possible in a given time period in a given location. And that's in May. And then the Harris Center, where I work, has several birding events in May also and early June.
Well, we'll make sure and put links for all of those events at our website. And Eric Masterson, thank you so much for ringing in the spring with us.
Thanks so much, Virginia.
Eric Masterson of the Harris Center in New Hampshire and also author of Birdwatching in New Hampshire. Again, more information on all those events and his book at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. While American urbanites are well familiar with pigeons, as we learn in this episode from the podcast Surprisingly Awesome, there's a lot about these city dwellers that we don't know.
But you just kept, so you were hooked.
I just want to explain what just happened, because to me it was amazing. Yeah. You grabbed a flying bird out of the air with your hands, then you were like checking its wings.
Yeah, looking at the wings, feeling how it had a body feels, yeah.
Yeah.
How did it feel?
Good. That's a daughter right there out of a bird that won $30,000.
This is Steve Rogers. He's a retired pipe welder, born and raised on Staten Island, still living there. And his whole life centers around racing pigeons.
So I want to set you up with a visual for this next piece of tape. We're entering what basically looks like a double-wide garden shed, but a pretty fancy one. It's about a full-story tall. It has vinyl siding that matches the main house. There's a lot of people in Manhattan who would kill to live in something this big. It's divided into these smaller compartments to keep the babies away from the grown-ups. It's well-lit and surprisingly clean. There's not too much poop there, considering the first thing you see when you walk in is a wall full of pigeons.
And you know, like at a carnival, when you throw a ring around a bottle and you win a stuffed animal and all the stuffed animals are just in that giant wall on shelves behind you? That's what the pigeons were like.
Until we show up.
Come on. Get out. Come on. You're going to land on your head?
Just get out of this section.
No, but like if you come in here alone, they don't fly around like this?
No. I just sit down on it. I got that little chair. I hand feed them. Yeah. These are your rat bastards.
And the crazy thing was is that Steve just kind of kept casually chatting with us. Like birds would whiz past his head. He literally snatched a couple out of the air as they were just flying around all around us. And he'd just kind of turn it over and be like, as you can see on this bird, he was so calm. And meanwhile, I was literally like cowered behind your big puffy jacket trying to stay low so I didn't get hit in the head by a pigeon.
I got to say, however scared I was not as scared as you, which made me feel slightly less ashamed.
Oh, I'm glad to be able to provide that service for you.
I appreciate it. And you pointed out, it's like someone being on one of those game shows where they put a contestant in a glass booth and there's a blower and all this money swirling around them.
Except, yeah, instead of money, it's pigeons and you don't want to touch them at all.
Although to Steve, to be fair, those pigeons are money. It costs a lot to take care of the birds. Steve's coop alone costs about $30,000 to build. Then there's feeding them really well. He has a very special mix and giving them medicine. The pigeons in Steve's coop are the same kind of pigeons as street pigeons, same species, same genus, same genetics, but they're not from the street, and you can tell that instantly when you see them. They're just cleaner, healthier. A street pigeon might live for 2 years. Steve's birds can live for a decade or more.
And because these birds are specially bred, they're really expensive.
But these are the breeders over here. These are the mothers and fathers. That hen down there, I just paid a grand for her. $1,500.
Steve points out it's the same as horse racing. You get a bird that's a winner, its babies are worth a lot, even its grandkids. The most expensive racing pigeon in the world sold for $310,000 back in 2013. It was named Bolt, as in Usain Bolt. A Chinese businessman bought it.
Pigeon racing in the U.S. has been on the decline since World War II. There's about half as many people racing pigeons now as there were back then. But internationally, there's still a lot of money in pigeon racing in the Middle East and China. But just because these birds cost a lot of money, it doesn't mean they're worth anything.
Same as horses. I mean, you buy a horse for $4 million. You don't know if it can run 4 feet. It could die on you in a friggin' stall.
And how'd you get into this?
I think it's a friggin' birth defect, I swear to God. I had them, I got a friend of mine's father had them, and he found an old coop in the woods. We took it apart and bought it into a lot by his house. And that's how we started. Yeah, and I'm still doing it.
How old were you?
12.
Do you name them at all?
No. I don't want to be friends with them. I gotta frame the shit out of them and race them.
It's helpful to understand how pigeon racing actually works. So he's training his pigeons all the time to come back to their coop, the coop they live in.
Right, and then when it's time for a race, he and a bunch of other guys in his region who also raise pigeons, they'll load their birds onto a truck, and the truck drives them hundreds of miles away to a place like Cadiz, Ohio, or Greenfield, Indiana, these towns with race stations in them.
Then all at once, all the pigeons are let go, and they start flying really fast as they can, back to their home coop. And this is how it's different from horse racing. They all have the same starting line, but each pigeon's finishing line is a little different. Each pigeon is racing to its coop.
And Steve, like all the pigeon racers, has had the exact distance measured from the racing station to his particular coop outside his house.
And each pigeon has a band around its leg that checks it in as it finishes the race.
It's all computerized now. It's like a freaking easy piss.
So have you won?
Yeah, I do all right, yeah.
And what do you win?
Money. What do you...
What's the best you've done?
I don't want to say.
All right. Tens of thousands?
Oh, yeah.
Are you ahead in pigeons?
Never ahead in pigeons. You're never ahead. It's like playing cards. And you just kind of stay even, you hope.
And it was clear when we were in the coop with Steve, it's not like these are his pets. They're just his hobby. They serve a purpose. It's more like they were like cars he was fixing up or model trains he likes to build. He really didn't seem attached to them as like living beings.
And hey, parents and animal lovers, you might want to dip the volume just for a few seconds for the next piece of information. Steve told us that when a bird from someone else's coop or a street pigeon wanders into his coop, he just wrings its neck. He doesn't know where those birds have been. They could get his birds sick. And what Steve does, by the way, is just one type of pigeon competition. There's also performance pigeons, the same pigeons, but bred for a whole other set of skills. There are tumblers, which are pigeons that compete based on their ability to do backflips while they're flying. There's rollers, which are pigeons that are better at forward flips.
There's tipplers. These guys are my favorite. These are endurance pigeons. So you've got Steve's pigeons, which might race for 8 or 9 hours to go from Ohio back to his coop in Staten Island. But tipplers can fly nonstop for almost a full day.
What? Why do you think you're into it? What do you get?
I just love it. I love to race. I love the action. It's like, how do you say it? It's like if you really like you want to play cards for money, or you want to chase women, or whatever you want to do, you do, and you enjoy it.
You know, John, it was right about this trip to Staten Island that I really felt my feelings about pigeons changing. When we started this, you were already pretty strongly on the pigeon train, right? You were liking pigeons, and I started out pretty grossed out by them.
I would say I felt solidarity with pigeons, and I held them in high esteem.
And that only got stronger. But for me, I started seeing them as this noble thing, and I started buying the argument that we human beings owe them some responsibility. And so I got in my head how excited I was to go back home, see the pigeons in my neighborhood in a whole new way. I got this really specific idea. I went to a pet store. I bought some bird seed because we were told along the way, don't feed pigeons bread. That's not good for them. I got a big sack of it. I was going to pick up my son, Ash, go to the park with him, and we'd sit on a bench and just feed the pigeons and watch them. People told me, if you watch pigeons long enough, you'll realize each one has its own personality. There are funny ones and stupid ones and aggressive ones and really shy ones and nervous ones and nice ones. I thought, oh, it'll be just like in Mary Poppins. We're going to have this glorious pigeon adventure together.
Feed the birds, tuppence a bag, tuppence, tuppence, tuppence a bag.
Feed and then we talked to a man who told me to cut it out.
How do I pronounce your name?
Daniel Haag Wackelnagel.
Yeah, I mean, the whole time I was in New York with you guys, I kept saying, we have to call Daniel Haag Wackelnagel. And I think maybe you guys thought I was making him up or something, or you'd sort of patronize me and sort of say his name one way or another way. But this guy, this is a real guy, Daniel Haag Wackelnagel. He's sort of the dean of urban pigeon science, and he is the dream crusher for you, Adam, when it comes to your fantasy of feeding pigeons in the park. He's got a really long history with pigeons, and it goes back all the way to when he was in something called the Pigeon Service in the Swiss Army, where they trained pigeons to send messages, just like Cheremie.
You just said that the Swiss Army still had a pigeon service when you were starting out?
It was about 15 years ago they stopped it.
In the 1980s, Daniel Haag Wackelnagel was a newly minted PhD in biology in Basel, Switzerland. And the city was experiencing this huge problem, a pigeon problem.
Like in a lot of cities, there was a core group of elderly folks that were feeding pigeons all the time. And not just casually feeding them, like at lunch, a few crumbs, but in a dedicated, routine way. They would have bags and bags of seeds, and they'd be tending entire flocks. And this really kind of disrupted the entire pigeon ecosystem. These pigeons can recognize a regular feeder, recognize the person's face from blocks away, and then the bird will just follow that person to wherever they normally get fed.
These people thought they were doing a great thing, but this new food source meant that Basel's pigeon population was exploding. It reached 25,000 birds. There were so many birds, they were living in slum-like conditions, all crowded up, getting diseases. Did you solve the pigeon problem of Basel, the overpopulation?
Of course, it's not possible to solve it definitively, but we could cause a reduction of the population for more than half.
Daniel started trying to explain to people, when you feed the pigeons, they have way too much time on their hands because they're barely spending any time looking for food. And when pigeons have too much time on their hands, you wind up with a lot more pigeons. Because if you don't control the food source, pigeons just keep breeding.
So Daniel launched what he called a pigeon action. It was basically an education campaign to tell everyone, please stop feeding the pigeons. You think that you're helping, but actually, this isn't good for us or for the birds. It was actually kind of cruel.
You do not do anything good for a pigeon if you feed them, because they become lazy. And if you are a couch potato, then you have a less good health condition than a person who works for food.
Right.
If they are fed every day at the same point, they don't fly out, and they don't have a good body condition, and they have a lot of time for reproduction. That's a problem. It's not good for the birds.
We live near a big park, and there's some people who feed the pigeons.
Yeah.
And my son is 4 years old, and, you know, like all four-year-old kids, he loves running through the pigeons and making them fly away. And I would discourage him from running into the pigeons. I felt like it wasn't nice. But you're actually saying that my son is doing the right thing for the pigeons and the person feeding them is doing the wrong thing.
All over the world, children run through pigeon flocks.
And that's good for them. That's like taking them to the gym. It gives them exercise.
So where does that leave us? We spent this whole episode, Adam, learning to appreciate pigeons. What do we do with that appreciation?
Yeah, that was my question. And Daniel Haag Wackelnagel basically said, if you learn to love them, let them go. You can admire them from a distance, but they are at their best now if we let them lead lives as wild as possible.
What Daniel's arguing is we have to fully break up with pigeons. We have to get to the point where if we show up at a park and they're there, we both just do our own thing.
No one's weird about it. There are no hard feelings.
A respectful breakup. Real mature. Don't throw them a pizza crust. Just let the birds go back to being independent animals.
Surprisingly Awesome is produced by Adam Davidson and Adam McKay for Gimlet Media. We heard an excerpt from their 9th episode, which is called Pigeons. We're so grateful for your listening time, but want to remind you that there's a lot more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also hear the show anytime with the Word of Mouth podcast. You find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please rate it. That will help others find it when shared by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.